Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
In his presidential farewell address, George Washington laid out an argument for the important role that religion would play in shaping the new nation. Washington said, quote, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizens. The mere politician, equally with the pious man, ought to respect and to cherish them. A volume could not trace all their connections with private and public felicity. And let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds of peculiar structure, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle." Unquote. But over the course of American history, there has been an increasing tendency to separate the religious arena from the public square, a tendency based upon a reading of Thomas Jefferson's famous wall of separation quote that we have dealt with in previous podcasts. Today, we constantly struggle with the issues of whether it is proper to place a Christmas tree in a town hall or to have religious invocations at public high school graduations, trivial matters as compared to whether or not morality needs to be part of the solution to some of our greatest social problems. But a little more than two centuries after Washington retired to his home in Mount Vernon, another George, George W. Bush, created a federal office wherein the government would assist religious organizations in providing charitable services to people and communities in need. Known as the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, this institution was designed to remove regulatory roadblocks from religious groups seeking to provide social services and to direct competitive federal grants to faith-based charities. This policy generated many critics who saw this office as an improper entanglement of government with religion. To discuss with us the origins of the faith-based initiative, its successes and failures, and to debate the merits of such an approach, I am joined today by Jay Hine, a distinguished senior fellow and director of the Program for Faith and Service at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion. Mr. Hine is also the founding president of Sagamore Institute for Policy Research, an international public policy research firm headquartered in Indianapolis, Indiana. But most importantly, at least for today's discussion, Jay was the director of the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives in the Bush administration from 2006 to 2008. Jay also has the rare and distinct honor of having his name appear in the title of a Supreme Court case related to the faith-based initiative, something we might discuss a little bit later on in the show. Jay, welcome to Research on Religion.
Tony, thank you very much for having me.
Before we discuss what the origins of the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives and its activities were under the Bush administration, let's talk about the nature of religious charity in America over the past two decades or so. That, I think, helps set the context for what is going on with the faith-based initiative. What extent do private charities or religious nonprofits, specifically religious nonprofits that I just said here, play and help to address our nation's most pressing needs?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the faith factor in neighbor, caring for neighbor, is as old as our nation. The founders recognized the indispensable role of virtue in ordering our society, just as they recognized the essential element of altruism, of which religion is a terrific generator, an essential characteristic in enabling democratic participation beyond government to social well-being. Tocqueville observed this himself. He famously said that when tragedy befalls an American citizen, the purse strings of 1,000 strangers open to him or her. And many quote Tocqueville. I don't know how many correct him. I would correct him to say that it isn't the purse strings of 1,000 strangers, but it is the purse strings of hundreds or thousands of neighbors.
Right.
We give and serve relationally. Research today by Bob Putnam, who would not classify himself as a Christian, to be sure. I'm not entirely sure of his faith orientation. He does not advertise such, but rather a esteemed sociologist has a new book called American Grace coming out, which traces the history and the contours of American generosity, in particular, with particular emphasis on those who claim faith as a motivator to their giving and serving, and says it is the predominant predictor for American altruism. So while you, in your preface, noted the long-running debate about whether and if so how faith should manifest in the public square, that's not a question that American citizens wrestle with, because the majority of people, again, who give and serve and form our nonprofit organizations, the majority claim faith as their motivation. So it's as old as we are as a country, and it's as embedded as the best of our nonprofit sector exhibits in its performance.
I think that that's one of the clear differences between the United States and in Europe, perhaps, is that the United States has oftentimes been criticized for being a stingy nation and that the government doesn't give a great deal of charity to other nations relative to, say, a Sweden or Finland or something of that nature. But our private sector, which they usually don't put into these comparisons, you know, the private individuals give an enormous amount, especially in compared to Europe. It seems Europe has really put the task of providing charity, quote-unquote charity, on the backs of the government, whereas here in the United States, we tend to rely more upon, as Tocqueville says, the purse strings of a thousand strangers, or as you say, 1,000 neighbors.
Well, that's right, and you know, Tocqueville observed it. It was remarkable to him because of the distinction, relying, as Europe does, on the welfare state. He noticed that Americans were faithful and also entrepreneurial. They were just acting, and they didn't feel like they needed permission or government assistance to care in really human scale for one another. And it is unique to the American experiment, and I think the numbers, the contemporary numbers, bear that out as well. And in America, we, for the 3 years in a row, have given in private charity over $300 billion.
Wow.
Religion being more than half of that number and the largest single source, similar to my commentary earlier. We volunteer in 70 or 80 million persons' numbers in that range. We have 1.5 million 501c3 organizations in America. The combined revenue of those organizations, $1.7 billion in their collected assets. Our nonprofit sector, if taken as a comparison in country economics, would outpace some of our Western allies' overall national budgets.
Mm-hmm.
That's how much, and most of those gifts, the philanthropic contributions that are donated to charities, most of those gifts are small individual gifts.
Mm-hmm.
But these private actors in the public interest and these very modest, sometimes small gifts roll up to very large numbers and collectively far outpace even the government participation in other of our allies' existence. One quick word about foreign assistance. Americans for decades in this past century were accused of being stingy in foreign aid because the percentage of our overall national budget was lower than, say, a Sweden or others that per capita would have a larger percentage number. Well, that at once ignored the gross number or the overall number, where American contributions, even through congressional appropriations, were far greater than many countries, of course, and the largest single source contribution to the developing world. but terrific new research from the Hudson Institute that has now been released 5 years in a row. The annual index of global prosperity shows that Americans through Congress, congressional appropriations, spending American tax dollars, is roughly in the $20 billion range.
Wow.
The private contributions to the developing world, so Americans that beyond what they've donated vis-a-vis their tax contribution, give on an order of four or five times greater, so maybe $70 million or $80 billion dollars are given in private contributions. As a matter of fact, United States congregations give roughly half of what America spends in government support through the State Department, United States Agency for International Development. So the numbers really are staggering, but they go to your point that we act as private citizens, individuals, corporations, private philanthropy in profound and a scope and a scale that is staggering and highly unique in the world, yet is embedded in the American character as our other chief democratic values and virtues, indispensable.
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, in listening to you discuss this, there's two things that I think need emphasizing once again in what you said. First of all, it's not just financial contributions. So you cite the Hudson Institute research, and you were talking $70, $80 billion of giving. But you also mentioned that it's personal time, it's volunteering, individuals giving of themselves to, you know, pack blankets to head down to Haiti or those things that matter quite a bit. And the other aspect of it is that it's on a small level, that when we think of philanthropy, we oftentimes think of somebody giving, you know, multi-million dollars to some kind of benefit. But, you know, really what it comes from is the millions and hundreds of millions of Americans just giving, you know, $10 here, $20 here, and that adds up over time. And I think in part of this, what we're discussing really sets up this tension or this balance between, you know, who should be providing aid for social ills, the private sector or the government sector. And in part, the faith-based initiative is trying to bring some of these things together. My question for you is, you know, as you go into this and as you've thought about this quite a bit, what were some of the difficulties or obstacles facing our religious nonprofit sector in the 1990s before the faith-based initiative starts ramping up?
Sure. Offer this context. I think both points that you raised, the recognition of the faith factor in the public square, and the transactional side of the equation, how public and private do business together, were really both colliding in the faith-based initiative, and I think it's worthy to do some spade work on that ground and to look at it from both angles. But let me make one point first, which is President Bush's motivation for creating the faith-based and community initiative, which he did via executive order. So this was an innovation to the Bush presidency. Actually, the first policy address that he made as a candidate, then Governor Bush, was in Indianapolis, where my think tank resides, and he went to an inner-city church in Indianapolis and articulated a vision for the initiative that framed our purpose in the context of a determined attack on need. This was about problem solving. This was about recognizing that in inner city America, more than 50% of the children who enroll as freshmen do not graduate. Too many are hungry and homeless. Too many are addicted and neglected. That these social burdens in society should be deemed unacceptable, and that we should respond with the best of American compassion and ingenuity. He felt that the best of that supply existed in volunteers and philanthropists and other social entrepreneurs. So when he used the term rallying Americans, armies of compassion, that's what he was referring to. He was saying this is not a faceless, bureaucratic, legislative hope that we should have, but rather we should place our hope in individuals, because as we've already established, that's how we've solved our problems most effectively in the past. So he was using the bully pulpit of a presidential campaign and then upon office a White House apparatus to say, we are going to lift up the arms of these inner-city entrepreneurs, and we're going to support them. Now, one form of support is a financial consideration, and we should get into that. I would just like to say on the top of that part of the conversation that, unfortunately, over the 8 years of the Bush presidency, it was government's financial support of faith-based charities that took almost all the oxygen. I really feel like that was an overemphasized part of the initiative because, firstly, the initiative was about so much more than government support. You know, the government financial support of faith-based charities almost makes it appear that it's about the government and what can the government do and what should the government do and with whom should they give favor. When the president's orientation, and I know this after working with him in Texas, as my think tank supported his Texas faith-based initiative, and then in the White House, I knew that he was first thinking about a citizen-centered solution, and indeed maybe we'll get into some of the ways that we supported faith-based charities beyond financial, which arguably was the majority share of our time even when we were in government positions. So having said that, though, and to go to your question, there were problems or dissonance or static that existed in this, you know, government faith-based sphere. And I think, Tony, that we need to begin looking at case law. There were court actions taken in the early part of the century that began to shift American attitude. You made reference to the Jefferson wall of separation line, which of course was inserted into constitutional precedent well past Jefferson's lifetime, when a justice made reference to it in a later court opinion. Jefferson's quote was, of course, used by him in the form of a letter, not in a constitutional consideration. And the case has been made that it was for far different purposes than it was used later on by the United States Supreme Court. Perhaps we can get into that. But at the sort of the macro level of the condition we inherited in the 1990s is that beginning in the 1920s and 30s, there began in America to American jurisprudence to trend in the direction of a pervasively sectarian standard, which is a legal reference to the court's opinion that religion was so threatening in the public square that if a entity was religious, that should be viewed with suspicion within the public square. And so there were higher bars established to protect, if you will, the American populace from religious influence in an attempt to protect religious freedom, this pervasively sectarian standard. Much of this jurisprudence was driven by an anti-Catholicism. There were Blaine Amendments, so named after a legislative leader who was anti-Catholic and wanted to diminish the role of parochial schools and other Catholic influence. It's a story of prejudice, sadly.
Right.
That court line of reasoning began to change in the 80s and spiked in the 90s toward a new legal standard called equal treatment, which simply says, look, if an entity is religious, that doesn't mean that they're somehow threatening. It means that they have a different type of character than another organization, but equally as welcome in the public square. So we shouldn't be asking questions of religion first and presuming a negative position, but rather in the public square, we should be asking questions about competency, And this all goes to the heart of a proper understanding of the First Amendment. And I'll conclude with this in case you want to go a different direction. But it's worth us, I think, fully appreciating the conundrum of the First Amendment, which does communicate two things at once. The First Amendment protects that us against the establishment of religion, and of course the founders, contrary to the British experience and other fears of having the government select one religion for its people, and it was the heart of our civil liberties to say that no, it's not the government's role to select religion for its people, but rather the second part of the First Amendment, which is said in the same breath, while government should not establish religion,
right,
we protect in our Constitution the free exercise of religion for all our citizens. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, means that we can choose or change our religion. We can be religious or non-religious and equally American all at the same time. So how do these two things coexist? Well, unevenly, I think we should say, with a proper understanding of American history. Courts have swung wildly in its interpretation of what that means, and the Bush faith-based initiative vis-a-vis government financial support of faith-based charities was motivated in part, long answer to your good question, in part as corrective action to end the discrimination that was a remnant or legacy of the pervasively sectarian standards, which has been rendered moot now in the jurisprudence which favors equal treatment.
Mm-hmm. I should note for our listeners here that we have several podcasts that have dealt with this issue, which I think is an absolutely fascinating one, this tension between, you know, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. We'll provide a link on our website, but the podcast by Mark David Hall of George Fox University and also Eric Stanley of the Alliance Defense Fund have addressed this directly. And you're right, this comes, you know, full square to the faith-based initiative here and trying to reconcile these both stands. The pendulum might have swung one direction by saying, well, let's keep religion as far out of the public square as we possibly can. But on the other hand, that it creates roadblocks to a lot of religious activity that prevents, you know, religious folks from doing their daily charitable activities. And I think that's what the faith-based initiative here meant to address. Now, when it was created in the Bush administration, what were some of the dimensions of it? What were the policy objectives that it was trying to achieve in the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives?
Sure. If I could just do a quick addendum to the discrimination point and under sort of the category of unintended consequences, let me thank you for spending your podcast focus in part on this issue, because I think American society operates with a rather high degree of illiteracy about what the First Amendment means and both a historic context and a legal context and a social context in many respects. And so thank you for doing that. What we observed in the White House is not only were federal agencies operating from a position of discrimination, and I'll go to that again when I answer your question about what we were set up to do, but the problem was worse. We found many corporate philanthropies and other nonprofits behaving as if they were also subject to some type of First Amendment limitation. So, for example, if a large American corporation's philanthropy, there were many of them who would not accept any grant request if you had saint in the title of your organization or if you some otherwise claimed faith as part of your mission.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt like that was necessary to comply with First Amendment law, which shows how far the misunderstanding grew. So not only was it misapplied within public policy and government behavior, but that extended very widely and still does today into even private philanthropy. And much of that is just misunderstanding and misconstrued conversation over these issues. So we have an educational role that is unfinished, and indeed, Faith-Based Initiative took on as one of its planks of activity this question. So then, in direct response to your question about what the office was intended to do, it was an office established via executive order. So the president signed an executive order calling on a White House faith-based and community initiative office. It's privileged to lead that particular office, but also faith-based and community initiative centers at 12 federal agencies. So being a policy guy, it was a great thrill for me to not only serve the president directly and to work with him on how he sends appropriate messages about our work and other activities of the president that we can get into, but also to work inside all of the major federal agencies and to have a direct communication channel to the secretaries of those agencies because I was representing the president. We were able to ask questions inside, you know, the Department of Labor about improving prisoner reentry employment opportunities, or the USAID about foreign assistance, and the Commerce Department about inner city revitalization and development, housing and urban development, about affordable housing options, and I can go on. So the purposes were both to end discrimination, so therefore to change rules and regulation and policy to level the playing field is the term we used, which was an effort to comply with this equal treatment principle, but also for what, you know, to answer the for what question. So it wasn't just ending discrimination and creating a level playing field. The main purpose of the organization was to solve bigger and more problems more effectively through public-private partnerships and artful collaboration between all actors in the public square. Mm-hmm. Government is present in all American communities, but is outpaced in scope and scale by nonprofit organizations and individuals. And so how can we consider new ways and better ways to respond to natural disasters? Well, you know, how is the American response to Katrina look? Well, it looks like on the day of the flood coming over the levee, it looks like private individuals who are already there. One of my favorites was a drug addiction ministry that was helping addicts heal from their addictions, became a housing ministry that day because, of course, people were displaced, and that was the need. So in an entrepreneurial, mission-directed, neighbor-focused way, that ministry on the ground, changed its focus and responded to need and did so beautifully. It took 5 or 6 days for the professionals, Red Cross included, to enter some of those neighborhoods because physically it was just impossible to move in certain areas.
Right.
Well, those are 5 or 6 days that the Armies of Compassion were on the ground because that's just the way it works. And those are the individuals who are still in those communities rebuilding. So our role was to identify new and innovative ways to solve problems, to identify who these problem solvers and community builders were, and to ask ourselves hard questions about what it would look like for us to fit into their world and to be a better partner to them. You know, government has some terrific assets, information and knowledge being chief among them. We take a lot of data. We have experts who analyze, and we have the authority to convene and to access a lot of information. We should share that, and we should, you know, include these faith-based entrepreneurs at the table in ways that they hadn't been invited before. And those are some of the not headline-grabbing, but very important blocking and tackling tactics and strategies that were made possible because of the president's initiative, but made actionable because we utilize the platforms of these federal agencies and their state counterparts to set a different agenda, which looked like not just the professionals driving the train, but the professionals inviting the real doers to to the table and to help lead the conversation.
I think that's a really important point to emphasize here, because when I talk to other people about the faith-based initiative, the initial thought that what is going on here is that this is basically a large, shovel dishing money to religious charities. But as you mentioned, it's really getting away some of the bureaucratic obstacles that faced a lot of these private charities that, you know, on a day-to-day basis, these private religious charities have to deal with government regulations that get in the way of doing things. And as I understand it, the faith-based initiative, one of its, you know, main principal legs was to get rid of some of these regulatory roadblocks to, as you say, unleash the armies of compassion that can really address a lot of the social ills there. So are there some more specific, you talked a little bit about Hurricane Katrina, but are there some more specific directed policies that you could mention that talk about how these regulatory roadblocks were removed and how it did help to empower some of these religious charities?
Right, sure, I can. And unfortunately, perhaps fortunately for you, we have time limitation, because I could go on and on. There were literally dozens of significant policy areas that we impacted. As a matter of fact, one of the ways that I attempted to communicate the diversity and the range of our approach was that every month at the White House, I was there for 2 years, as you made reference, and each month I hosted a Compassion in Action roundtable where we selected each month a different public policy issue. And we ranged from human trafficking and addiction recovery and reducing youth violence and on through with a rotating set of co-sponsors. So each month I would partner with a different federal agency. Their Secretary of Veterans Affairs would come over, for example, mm-hmm. and cast vision for what they were doing to build new public-private partnerships and to address these really stubborn, burdensome problems. Education Department, I mentioned the dropout rate, issues of marriage formation, family health, and domestic violence. It just goes on and on. But my format was to bring an executive office, the First Lady, or cabinet members to give a little bit of gravitas and higher order kind of perspective to the administration's work. And then, though, the stars of the show, the main presenters on a White House platform, were the faith-based and community entrepreneurs who I identified were highest performing in that space. So they were able to come. I would sort of set the stage with context, defining the need. Cabinet agency would talk about where the administration was headed in support of the work of the people who would be our keynote speakers, if you will, those who are actively involved in their communities doing this work. And then they could talk about what it takes to slay these dragons. And it was just so inspiring. And we ran out of months before we ran out of subjects, to be sure. We completed a final report at the end of the administration, which is a 100-page document that talks about the full range of our activities. And, the subject matter, again, goes on to homelessness and so many other individual pursuits. We could sort of go through a laundry list here, but let me tell you maybe just a couple of our signature initiatives, one at home and one abroad. At home, the president had a particular burden for prisoners reentering society, because in part, sort of from a vision and value standpoint, the president believes that America is a place of second chances. So while he's a Republican, he's part of the Law and Order Party. We had an unprecedented number of men and women incarcerated in the late 80s and early 90s. Well, they leave prison at some point, the majority of them, and we found in the late 90s and in the early 2000s that that there were roughly 700,000 or so leaving a federal correctional facility each year, and two-thirds of them were rearrested within 2 years, mm-hmm. which is just a terrible public policy. I mean, from a public policy perspective, something's not working here. So, while the president believes in redemption, and he's spoken before of the faith his own personal faith and the transformation that resulted from his past lifestyle as someone who drank too much, to use his words. And he teased, I went to a prisoner reentry site visit with him, and he shared with the guys that hear a lot about the 12-step program. He said, I actually had a one-step program. I found the Lord, and I quit drinking. But it's a serious subject for him. He understands that that life transformation can occur, and so he wanted to communicate that message to those, these 700 or so thousand coming back to prison. But it's also a public safety issue. It's an economic issue. It's a community well-being issue. So we established an initiative, which was not a government grant program, but rather a White House effort to call on churches to generate volunteer mentors. Mm-hmm. Normally when someone leaves prison, they're met outside the prison gates by the same social network that helped them arrive in prison, you know, the same gang or the same sort of drug network and negative influences. Inside prison, too often, the prisoner's experience is not a healthy one, but rather one that enlarges some of the deviant behavior that would lead to this two-third rearrest rate statistic. Well, the president wanted to break that cycle, again, not through a grant or a government program, but through a loving and caring and high expectations mentor. Mm-hmm. Churches provided the majority of these mentors, and for both the prisoner, we also started a program for the children of prisoners to break the cycle of criminal behavior, which is all too prevalent. And it was a stunning success, this program, and that was one domestic effort that within the first year showed remarkable gains in reducing the recidivism rate or the rearrest rate of prisoners. Abroad, you may know the story of the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. AIDS, of course, has been a death sentence in Africa,
right.
So much so that, you know, families sort of push out family members who are diagnosed, and that leads to a large degree of denial or hiding, which only inflames the problem. So, you know, this has become, you know, the largest pandemic in human history. Tens of millions of Africans dying without any hope. And so the president created this initiative early in his presidency to administer American medical aid at a profound scope and scale. And it has been just an unbelievable success, and we can get into some of the details of the public policy. But specific to the faith-based and community initiative, one of the largely unreported distinctives of our aid is that it wasn't just generous. It isn't that we just put a lot of money in mm-hmm. medicine and medical apparatus, but that we did so in a way that empowered African faith-based and community organizations. So rather than putting billions of dollars in the hands of Western non-government organizations that would pop in, serve people, maybe effectively, hopefully effectively, but then withdraw, is the nature of, you know, the Western non-government organization apparatus. Instead, we would invest in the capacity of indigenous faith-based and community groups in Africa, which is prevalent, and then there would be a sustainable solution. So 80% of our grantees, the organizations that delivered these services, were indeed African faith-based and community initiatives. Rick Warren and I traveled to Kigali, Rwanda, and held a conference with Rwandan President Paul Kagame on this theme.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to your point earlier about American church members and people of faith that send themselves, not just their money, worldwide. You know, Rick speaks to this phenomenon by way of saying, you know, the church was the first. The church did globalization before there was even a term.
Right.
You know, and so there are. From missionaries and others serving overseas to the Africans themselves who claim faith as their number one influence in serving as well. And the church is the most respected institution in Africa, even more so than the police and other public services. Oftentimes those are corrupt organizations, sadly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rick Warren and others have helped us conceive of strategies that led to our administration formalizing partnerships, sometimes through money. I gave an international example where we were actually doing business, foreign assistance and development, through grant making to these organizations. But in the American prison context, it wasn't about grants. It was about mobilizing and training, galvanizing volunteers from the church to do the historic role of the church, which is to show up in society as salt and light.
I think that's one of the absolutely fascinating aspects, and I'm glad that you highlighted this here because, you know, normally when we think about, you know, government getting involved in this, we think of it shoveling money to organizations. But, you know, a huge part of the faith-based initiative was just to empower these, you know, organizations, not only, you know, monetarily, as we talked about before, but at the beginning of the podcast, we talked about the volunteer, the individuals, you know, providing their volunteer services, the missionaries or people, as you mentioned, on the ground in Africa, actually doing this. And, you know, that's something that's really not recognized by the faith-based initiative, and I think one of its strongest suits. Let me switch gears a little bit, though, and you talked about, you know, money and grants and stuff. And I know another aspect of the faith-based initiative was for the government to provide competitive grants to faith-based organizations. And how did that work, and how well did that succeed?
Well, from the grant-making perspective, we need to, again, sort of turn back in history and acknowledge that since World War II in America, political scientists refer to a phenomenon as this as a sort of government by proxy, that as the Industrial Age ensued and society became more complex and our population base grew, government did not provide, since the World War II era, the majority of services. We sort of speak as such, like, well, the government would do this.
Right.
And, you know, private would do that, and really for the entire modern era, government has not provided services. Government has indeed purchased services. This is the government by proxy notion. So they have already formed, you know, it's just a decades-long history of financial partnerships with America's nonprofit sector. And that's another way of saying faith-based and community organizations, because what we know of these 1.5 million organizations that I referenced earlier, that that faith-based and community, that title was a recognition that that our nonprofit sector is comprised of both. So it's a little bit of marketing in the title to draw specific attention to faith-based organizations, A, because they're majority actors, and we need to recognize that, B, because they had become objects of discrimination, and we wanted to correct that, but then also to not leave it at faith. It wasn't a faith-based initiative. Some people use that shorthand. It was intentional that we said "and community," because this was an initiative about organizations of faith or more general goodwill, and that would claim that as their motivation. This was about need, and it was about results. So when it came to public administration, we certainly needed to pay attention to the discrimination that existed. If St. Mary's of the Woods would be an organization that the Department of Housing and Urban Development would not even consider an application from because that of their title, which is an example of the kind of discrimination we came across. This was not thoughtful discrimination. Much of it was really, you know, a very high form of the illiteracy we were talking about earlier. It was just really kind of stunning. Paul Revere's church, the Old North Church, was deemed ineligible to receive a historic preservation grant because it was a church, when we know the remarkable role the lanterns played in American history, in the American Revolution, just stunning degrees of discrimination. So certainly we needed to address that. But when it came to the grant-making process, that was an older story than a newer story. In post-Katrina, I visited New Orleans, and Catholic Charities took me to a facility with great pride to them. They said, well, we want to introduce you to the first faith-based initiative that we're aware of, or faith-based organization that participated with government. And it was the Catholic Charities office in New Orleans that received a government grant in the 1800s. And so the story is long and winding and somewhat uneven, as I referenced earlier. But we weren't starting the grant making process, nor were we, with proper respect to the First Amendment, nor were we providing any form of preferential treatment to religious organizations or faith-based organizations. Ending discrimination was not showing preference. It was actually just creating equal treatment. So there were no dedicated programs to somehow give favor to religious organizations. Actually, Bill Clinton did do that. Mm. There was a particular government program established at the end of the Clinton presidency that exclusively benefited religious organizations. We actually ended that program and said this needs to be about equal treatment and the capacity of these organizations to win whatever points in the awards competition they can based on their skill set and the promise of their high performance. This isn't a new story, but poorly understood both in terms of legal and also sort of orders of magnitude. So one of the things we did was actually counted the contractual dollars to these organizations, and there were roughly $20 billion or so that we identified in a year that the federal agencies had purchased services from religious organizations or faith-based groups, and that's a number far short of the overall government by proxy number that we have, but it just shows you that there are a whole lot of faith-based organizations active. The number was somewhat, one of my favorite sort of anecdotes was Idaho. I would go to the governor's conference in Idaho on service and volunteerism and talk about the $50 or $60 million of grants that state's faith-based community won from the federal government, which is a very complex process. It's very difficult to win a government grant, and the governor would have really wide eyes looking at me saying, really, do we have that many organizations here that to begin with, I mean, the sort of charities by themselves and faith-based charities in particular don't often receive great respect in the just sort of the realm of public opinion to begin with. It's oftentimes seen as sort of a nice thing on the side. I was able to demonstrate with a map showing where these organizations are that just the ones sophisticated enough to win government grants were this many, and they were winning this much support. So it goes to sort of one of my central strategies, which is to show that the Faith-Based Community Initiative was not only a big-time Washington initiative, resident in the White House and these federal agencies, but it was a 50-state initiative. Mm-hmm. And many governors had formed their own Faith-Based Community Initiative offices, roughly, I think, 36 of them did, majority Democrat governors, actually. But in all 50 states, there was a faith-based and community initiative working its way out through the contracting process. So it's actually, Tony, a pretty old story and a pretty big story and a terribly understood story. It's just poorly understood.
Mm-hmm. No, it's absolutely fascinating to see that this is working not just at the federal level but at the state level. And I know some of the, early models for the faith-based and community initiative did come from, places like Idaho and I think Kansas. There was one in operation or something along that line. Let me get to this. Some of the critiques of the faith-based and community initiative approach, though, is again, there's this image that was portrayed in the media that this was basically a payoff to Bush's evangelical voter base. And that they're basically just handing out money to these organizations. Was that really the case, or what was really going on there?
Right. It's really quite stunning that claim not only was made, but that it had such a shelf life because a couple of it just could not be farther from the truth. And said more pointedly, there was never evidence to that effect. So how could that storyline sort of surface in the public narrative and become such a part of the sort of a general impression of the initiative is really quite stunning from a public communication standpoint. Let me put a couple things together. When we talked earlier about these Compassion in Action roundtables and the non-financial strategies of the initiative, whereas the impression of this being a sop or somehow a favor to the religious right, of which, you know, let's also acknowledge that many on the right actually opposed the initiative because they were so fearful of government intrusion, and I think that that's actually a healthy fear. Perhaps we could get to that point from a philosophical level later, but while that story took root, the White House Press Corps, which is not small in number, dozens of reporters who work at the White House, physically present day to day, and I held, you know, a couple dozen of these Compassion in Action roundtables. A grand total of zero of them covered the roundtables. They wouldn't take the time to come over and hear about the 20 million people worldwide in human bondage, this human trafficking question, mm-hmm. and to hear about the innovative ways that that crime is being prosecuted and those victims are healing as a result of faith-based in community organizations. They just dismissed it out of hand. They just found it not germane to their coverage of the White House. So they covered zero of the content, yet they would pop up stories with such uninformed and really kind of political edge. I sound naive, perhaps, to express, you know, bewilderment that happens in Washington, but that is indeed what our reality was. So much so, if I could give you one more anecdote, in June of 2008, we held a national conference. 1,500 people filled the ballroom. This is the last year of our presidency, President Bush's administration, and you would think that interest should be waning at that time. We had to turn people away. It also shows the fullness of his commitment to this initiative that started in the first weeks of his presidency and was concluding in his last year with this grand conference where we'll talk about the difference made and the new strategy still being articulated. You know, standing room only crowd for the president's speech, and it was a 2-day event. Well, the week after that conference, Barack Obama, United States Senator at that point, campaigning for the presidency, held a press conference in Zanesville, Ohio, where he pledged his commitment to sustain the faith-based community initiative, that if elected, he would continue the office. USA Today's editorial board editor contacted me after the Obama announcement, and remember, we had our national conference the week before, mm-hmm. teeming with people and results, and in the middle of Obama's press conference, he actually claim that contrary to the Bush initiative, which was just a photo op, to go to your point, that's how he characterized our 8 years of work, which we don't have time in this hour to fully capture because there was so much activity. He called it, rather than the Bush approach of a photo op, you know, that he would do something more meaningful. So the USA Today editorial board contacted me, the editor, and he said, we USA Today will be editorializing in support of, you know, presidential nominee Barack Obama's faith-based initiative, and we're inviting you, as director of President Bush's faith-based initiative, to write the opposing view. Would you like to do that?
Uh-huh.
And I was just dumbfounded. I said, so presidential candidate Barack Obama is going to, he's pledging that he'll continue the initiative George Bush created, and you want me to write the opposing view? It was unbelievable, and indeed that they were sincere. And so it goes to your point that there was a very deep incorrect impression of what the initiative was, mm-hmm. That we need to chalk up to terribly misconstrued communication that probably has any number of sources. Perhaps some internal, even to the administration, but nonetheless, the sadness is that that our initiative was misunderstood. The good news is that matters far less than the actual work. And President Bush was consistent in his admonition to me to pay attention to the substance and building the initiative week after week by addressing more problems and engaging more partners and to consider with bullishness non-government, non-financial strategies at the same time, even if it didn't receive the attention or the acclaim of observers. Now President Obama has fulfilled his promise to keep the office, and it's alive and well inside the White House.
Mm-hmm.
It categorically is 100% coloring inside the lines that we established. They've
mm-hmm.
changed zero, and sadly, they've done a little bit less. They've downgraded the position of the director, and they've reduced the staff. So they're doing a little bit less than we did, and that's unfortunate. But they're continuing the directional emphasis. They're not receiving any press criticism of advancing faith in the public square, and I think that that's actually a positive because that shows health and positive change. But that's not where we need to place our trust. We need to place our trust for the future of the faith-based initiative, not in the White House, and I'll say that as being one who served there, but in each of our communities where the faith-based initiative, faith-based community organizations work tirelessly every day.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the outreach, and we were talking a little bit about how this was perceived as a big sop to the Christian right. Were there outreach efforts to minority churches in the African American Latino community and beyond the Protestant faith? I mean, we talked about Catholic Charities, which has been in existence for as you mentioned back into the 1800s. Was there in efforts to really extend beyond what one would consider the typical Republican constituency?
Yes. Well, let me sort of explain the complexity of White House outreach because we're observing it in the Obama administration. It happened in the Clinton administration before ours. There is an office in the White House called different things.
Mm-hmm.
For us, it was called Public Liaison. Obama calls it Public Engagement. But there's an office inside the White House whose job it is to do outreach, to communicate the administration's messages or to galvanize potential partners. And each of these administrations, these modern administrations, have prioritized faith communities as part of their outreach. But that's political activity. They're trying to gain support for the president, and so they'll reach out to Jewish leaders and Catholic leaders and other, the Baptists, the Mormons, they'll reach out, and those religious organizations will want an audience with the president or the president's staff to talk about the direction of the administration or certain policies, and that's just a pro forma part of government. That is not what we did in the Faith-Based and Community Initiative office.
Mm-hmm.
That was, that was done by our team in the White House, by Public Liaison. It's done by the Obama administration team under Public Engagement. So there's an outreach effort
mm-hmm.
that does exist and is a little bit it's political, and I think it's a little bit higher level. They're not building anything. They're not advancing any real particular strategies. It's just more of a conversation. And for us though, when we did, any outreach that we did was issue driven. So if we wanted to better understand substance abuse dilemma or human trafficking or some of the other public policy issues, our outreach was to find out who's doing what, what does the research show as best practice,
mm-hmm.
or promising new ideas, and so our the determined attack on need charge that our office was given meant that we were about problem solving and partnership development with a purpose. And I hope that's how the Obama Faith-Based and Community Initiative is operating. There is evidence, I think troubling evidence, that they're blending the lines, that the Faith-Based and Community Initiative team under the Obama administration is actually doing some of the political outreach. And we were accused of that. We didn't do it in our office. They're not being accused of it. I fear they are doing it. I feel that it's important, but it's also a minor part of the equation. You know, for those of us that care about the problems and the solutions needed, you know, are better served with you know, Baylor Institute of Studies of Religion, of which I'm so proud to be affiliated, and other organizations that are advancing the substance. And we need to read that material and to inquire further into nature and causes and solutions. The political narrative exists, it needs to be understood, but it can be distracting and it can major in the minor.
Yeah. Let me finish up with one a point here. We mentioned the Supreme Court case that you were named in during the at the introduction of this podcast, and it encompasses one of the critiques, and this kind of wraps us around to this issue of, you know, to what extent does the, you know, religious community become involved with the government, and vice versa. Tell us a little bit about that. The title of the case, it's a shortened title. I know Supreme Court cases have very long titles, but this was Hine versus Freedom from Religion. And what was the basis of their critique, and what was the result of this Supreme Court case?
Right, very interesting episode in my tenure, of course. Freedom from Religion Foundation, headquartered in Madison, Wisconsin, is an advocacy organization. It is not a team of lawyers interested in, you know, First Amendment jurisprudence. Instead, it's an advocacy organization dedicated to the pervasively sectarian line of thinking. You know, as their name suggests, they think neutrality in the public square means an absence or a deletion of religion altogether. That's their view as an advocacy organization, and so they do become involved in lawsuits by way of advocacy and engaging lawyers to take up their cause. When President Bush established the faith-based and community initiative, Freedom from Religion Foundation immediately sued. The president, among our other duties, we held conferences where we trained over 100,000 social entrepreneurs, faith-based and community leaders, on how to recruit volunteers and build better boards of directors and many, many just good nonprofit practice solutions, how to, you know, market more effectively and among private philanthropy and raise private dollars, in addition to introducing these organizations to our federal agencies and how to partner with them more effectively, teaching do's and don'ts if they're interested in government contracts, what is allowable vis-a-vis the First Amendment and what isn't. And we trained many, many nonprofit leaders in that regard. Among them were leaders of religious charities, 501c3s, that claimed a faith orientation. And because of that, simply because of that, the Freedom from Religion Foundation sued the administration, saying by virtue of having those organizations in the room, we were out of order in a First Amendment interpretation. And so they filed suit, and sort of the long story short is the lower courts disagreed on whether the Freedom from Religion Foundation even had the right to bring the suit, because the American legal system, you know, was not set up for ideological debate. It, you know, it's a court system set up to redress injury. You know, if American citizen is hurt, they should have their day in court and the ability to seek damages. And the lower court was debating whether or not Freedom from Religion Foundation could prove that they were somehow hurt in all of this. What was their point? They just seemed to be sort of making an argument. Well, there was a disagreement among the lower court opinions, so the Supreme Court agreed to take the case to sort this out and to establish their precedent on the matter, which was indeed whether the Freedom from Religion Foundation had a right to bring such a suit. So it's rather narrow court consideration, and the case changed from Freedom from Religion Foundation versus the Bush administration to Hine versus Freedom from Religion Foundation, so named because I was director of the office when the case was heard, is that it became us challenging their right to even bring the case. Aside from the particular elements of the court decision, which was decided in favor of the administration and against Freedom From Religion Foundation, saying indeed they did not have right to bring such a suit. The precedent, you know, the precedent has been rather wide ranging. There's more than a couple dozen cases that have been dismissed, deemed frivolous attacks on faith-based charities, not substantive ones. And so the Hine case, if you will, that's how it's being referred to, is having a positive effect, positive for those that think that the faith-based organizations belong in the public square, by way of sort of further ending the thoughtless discrimination that had taken root in American society, and toward the equal treatment status that that is fair and still vigilant in protecting individual religious freedom as well.
Well, it sounds like a really positive development here in terms of the faith-based initiative, and we can only hope that it will continue under future administrations in the way that you've really provided a pathway of bringing together the public sphere with the private religious sphere in ways that really seems, as the many examples you've given through the AIDS initiative, the prisoner reentry, that have really created positive effects in our society. And hopefully as we move on throughout our history, that, you know, religious charities and the government will be able to work hand in hand in providing a better life for many people, as it should be here in our great nation. Well, Jay, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion. We didn't cover all the topics that we wanted to get to, so we're going to have you back again in the near future. And for those of you who do have some questions about this podcast, I should note that we now have a comment feature available on our website, so you can ask questions, make comments, and possibly debate this amongst yourselves. So we encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to participate in this ongoing conversation. And again, Jay Hine of Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion and the Sagamore Institute, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you so much, Tony. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.